Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Tuesday, April 26th, 2016, starting at 1:30 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 73rd episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with astrologer Demetra George about her life and career in the field of astrology as part of a new series of biographical episodes that I've been planning for a while. So let's go ahead and get started. Demetra, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, let's start right from the beginning. We're gonna take this from sort of the beginning of your life and then work our way all the way into the present. So we everybody knows you're an astrologer and you're one of the I would say the most famous astrologers in the world. But I want to take it back to sort of the start of your story for people that don't know you very well or maybe are familiar with your work but don't know a lot about your history. And first ask sort of where do you come from? What's your place of origin and what's your family background? In terms of growing up and how you got started?
Well, I was born in Chicago in 1946, and I was born into a Greek family. Both of my both sets of grandparents had emigrated here from Greece in the 1900s. As the families were much more nuclear oriented in that area, it was my two grandmothers who were my primary caretakers. And as a consequence, my first language was Greek. And you have here, like, what was my background in mythology? It started at the very beginning with my Greek yayas telling me the stories of the Greek gods and goddesses as my bedtime stories. However, because of circumstances and the early death of my father. By the time I was 8, my mother had remarried and we were no longer living within the Greek subculture. And so at that point, I had lost my knowledge of Greek and I was only speaking English, which I heard that they didn't teach me English until I went to kindergarten at 5. So that's just an interesting mix of the languages somewhere deep in the recesses of my brain.
That's really interesting in terms of how things turned out later. And so you grew up sort of learning and being told like the stories of Greek mythology from a very early age.
Yes. Yeah. Those were instead of, Cinderella and Snow White, I would hear about Athena and Artemis and Aphrodite and Zeus.
Okay. And so eventually, I mean, did you have any interest in astrology or did you know anything about it during this period or is that something that came in later?
No, I don't think it came into really my full awareness until I was in college. And I remember being an undergraduate and hearing that some upperclassmen that I knew of were going, and I was in a college about 100 miles north of New York City. And once a week, they would get together and drive down to the city to take astrology classes. And I thought that was very interesting and very exotic. And they would come back saying, not only did we have these great classes, but she served us the most wonderful dinner. So you get a meal along with the class. This would become very, what you're calling now a foreshadowing another 10 years later. But at this point, this was my awareness of the astrology. And I think that, I did go to an astrologer in Poughkeepsie for a reading, but I didn't have my birth time. And it was about a 25-minute reading. And she just opened up her ephemeris while I was there and said some things, none of which really made all that much sense. So those were my two exposures to astrology during my college years.
Okay. And you were born in Chicago, but you grew up in New York, right?
Right. After the age of 6, I grew up in New York and primarily on Long Island.
And just for the sake of sort of locating things chronologically, do you share your birth data?
Certainly. It's out there on the internet, so it's not a problem. It's July 25th, 1946 at 6:22 a.m. in Chicago, Illinois. And that's the Central Standard Time. So 21 Leo rising is the correct ascendant.
Okay. So when we're talking about you being in college, we're talking about the early 1960s at this point, right?
Yes, 1964 to 1968.
Okay. So you're in college, and what's your sort of focus or what's your career path at that point?
I'm a math major, and I fell in love with calculus during my freshman year of math. I remember the joy of sitting down with some sort of proof and going into that other alternative space for hours at a time, and then coming out of it with this elegant, like, equation that had been solved. So I was in math, and by my sophomore year, I was tutoring freshman physics. And I had a trajectory either as a math teacher or close by where my school was in New Paltz in New York was IBM starting up in Poughkeepsie. And there were many people looking toward careers at IBM upon graduation. But several things happened. One was the 60s and all of the revolutions on many levels that were happening at that time. And also I had to take some liberal arts courses, and one of them was philosophy of science. And before I knew it, I ended up as a philosophy major after having completed all of the requirements for the math major.
Okay, so you switched from math to philosophy later in your college career?
Right, and that was my eventual degree, undergraduate degree, was in philosophy.
Okay. And then did you finish, or what happens at this point? So we're getting towards the end of the 1960s.
Right, we're getting into the beginning of 1969. And I remember having just two more classes I needed to complete my degree. And my boyfriend was making plans to travel to Europe and India. And I didn't want to be left behind, so I decided to go along with him on this journey and finish up my college later. So in 1969, we... at the beginning of that year, set off on the Icelandic prop airplane that landed in Reykjavik and then went on to Europe. And before long, we found ourselves traveling to Istanbul and then going overland across Turkey through Iran, spending many, many months in Afghanistan and into Pakistan. And that took up the better part of 1969.
Wow.
And then as the money ramp began to run out that we had in Pakistan, we decided to turn back and return to the United States. But in retrospect, it's been so interesting to me that I traveled through all these lands where so much of our political history is happening now. In Pakistan, I went up into the tribal territory areas where now Al-Qaeda has its centers and bin Laden was hiding. And I have a picture of myself on top of the Khyber Pass. So it continues. I have an incredible interest in the peoples of that area, a huge love of the Afghanis. It was the most amazing experiences I had during that time. And in many ways, that trip completely changed my perspective of how I would come back and see the rest of the world and the rest of my life. Because previous to that, I was 22, and I thought reality was the way I had grown up on Long Island. And I got to these other parts of the world where reality was like, very, very different, and things that made logical sense in the West, like things didn't work that way in the East, and no one there saw that as an aberration or a problem. So one of the examples that I use that I still can't sort out was going from, going east across Afghanistan. Our trip was on an old bus and it was mostly uphill and it was during the daytime and we stopped forever for a chai stops, for tea stops. And the trip that we took between these two cities, was 12 hours. And then coming back, the same leg of the journey was on a first class bus that went downhill that didn't stop at all at night. And it took 24 hours. And it was just like beyond me to understand the logic and things like that. But those were experiences we were encountering all the time. So that kind of shift of multi perspectives, of multi realities, of just the way you think this is the way it works here doesn't mean that that's universal. That's one of the most important pieces I carried back with me as then I began, you know, my as I entered into my 20s and had the rest of my life in front of me.
Sure. So eventually you guys decided to turn back, and by 1970 you're back in the United States?
Right. At the very end of 1969, we're back in the United States. Meanwhile, a number of our friends from our college town where we were living had traveled to the West and were living on a commune in Oregon. So that seemed like the next adventure to see what they were up to. And so it was in the winter of 1970 that I came to Oregon. They were living on some land up in the Siskiyou Mountains in southern Oregon that was a lease from the BLM. And there were about 40 or 50 people, most of which I had gone to school with. And then another whole era of my life started where that happened for the next 4 years. And we were on a mountaintop without running water or electricity or telephones or televisions or radios. And learning how to live in a pristine wilderness. When I arrived, there was a library of maybe 500 books, many of which were metaphysical books. There were all kinds of astrology books and books on the theosophists and the Indian sages and the Tibetans and psychic healing and tarot. And so this was the material that we were reading and discussing as we were chopping wood to cook dinner over wood-burning stoves and hauling water from a stream and boiling it on fire so we could scrub our clothes. And so the lifestyle was incredibly close to the earth, unplugged from the rest of the world, but the intellectual discourse was in the whole realm of metaphysical subjects.
Okay. So, and this is the point where you sort of started to get your first real exposure to astrology?
Yes. There were maybe 20 books on astrology there. My second season, I knew I didn't want to spend continuing to crochet patchwork Afghans. I sort of laugh at myself because when I first arrived at the commune, my progressive moon was in Taurus. And so learning how to bake bread and do patchwork quilting and knit and crochet were like wildly exciting. But as soon as my progressive moon went into Gemini, then, and that being my natal moon, it was like, once again, looking for the intellectual stimulation. So I remember Llewellyn George's book, ABC Horoscope Maker and Delineator, was there. And I sat down with it. I was about 5 months pregnant then with my first child. And in a period of a few days, I taught myself how to erect a chart. And I was off and running on casting charts and beginning to learn the language of astrology. I was taking a correspondence course with the Rosicrucian Society at Oceanside, where I would get a lesson and do it and send it back and have it corrected. And beginning to read the charts of the other people who are living on the commune that ranged, you know, our population ranged from 35 or 40 in the winter to over 100 in the summertime. And so that there was a whole audience of people who were very happy to have me practice and to learn the art of chart reading on them.
Okay. And so you're learning astrology, you're casting charts. So you have like the Llewellyn George book. Were there any other major books that were really influential or that you were reading at this point, this early stage?
I remember my child was born in January and sitting curled up in a rocking chair in front of a wood-burning stove, reading Rudyard's Astrology of Personality, Alice Bailey's Esoteric Astrology, Llewellyn George, and then with my studies with the Rosicrucians, Max Heindel's book was one of the books that we were using. So those are the four that I have my most vivid memories of.
Okay. So, and you take a correspondence course, and then eventually you've been on the commune for a few years, and then at some point you've been doing astrology for a while now, and you decide to venture out into the broader community, and you attend your first conference?
I do, and that was in April of 1973. Rudyard, who was my new hero, was going to be speaking at a conference in San Francisco. So it wasn't too far of a drive. So my husband and I and our new baby like got in the old pickup truck and drove down to San Francisco. And I remember walking into the conference on a Friday evening. And I sometimes tell this story and I laugh. I was like dressed up in my hippie vest with my long hair braided and flowered. And I get into this lobby and I see all these like other women in suits with high heels and fingernail polish. And I, you know, my Leo rising cringes, realizing that I'm not quite dressed appropriately for the occasion.
All right. So this is this like an AFA conference or what kind of?
It was called NASA, and it was, I think sponsored by Henry Weingarten and Barbara Summerfield, who are from New York City, but they're having it in some, a college campus, building. I think it was maybe Lone Mountain State College building in San Francisco.
Okay. That's a funny, like, cultural difference though, in terms of when you look at some of the old pictures of old conferences from like the 1940s and 50s, it's like they're all dressed up in tuxedos and like nice ballroom dresses and stuff like that.
Definitely. That was it. And of course, I was coming out of the commune. I thought, well, anyone who's into astrology, of course, has to be part of this new age. And then having that experience, oh, well, maybe not. Like, what world have I walked into?
Sure. So did you meet other young astrologers there? Were there other people that were more from your age? Because it's interesting because like at the same time, like 1968, you have Linda Goodman's book coming out and becoming the biggest selling astrology book of all time. But that's not necessarily, I mean, I guess that kind of straddles the division between like a New Age book and something that's more of just like a pop astrology book. But you would think that at that point, so many more people are getting into astrology and are excited about it, that you would see more of a mix by the early 1970s.
Let's see, that Friday night keynote speakers were Rudyard and Gokhale.
Okay.
And the rest of the conference, I was not able to attend because I had this like year old baby who was not doing very well, even for one night being without me. And so it was okay. Well, I got to go to this and I had to be happy with that exposure. So I didn't have the opportunity to really network or to meet a lot of other people who were there.
Okay.
But the formative moment of that conference was walking into the lobby, not knowing anyone, and there being a friendly looking woman standing to the side of me, that I sort of moved toward as she smiled and engaged me in conversation. And that woman turned out to be Eleanor Bach, who was responsible for having published the first asteroid ephemeris. They had just been published 3 weeks ago, and she had copies of the book in her purse. And as she spoke to me, and she found out that my name was Demetra, which was my grandmother's name, and Demeter was the Greek equivalent of the goddess Ceres, the Latin name goddess Ceres, who was the first asteroid discovered and was the goddess that Eleanor was crazy to know about where it was in her chart. And that's what spurred her for years to get an astronomer to compute the ephemerides so she could find out where Ceres was in her chart. You have to remember this was way before computers. And she found out that Ceres was on her ascendant, which like totally redeemed her quest. But anyway, when Eleanor found out Ceres, my name was Demetra. The asteroid Ceres was opposite my sun. I lived on a commune where we were growing organic vegetables. She said to me, I think you should have a copy of my book. And she gave me her book. Years later, I found out that she was the astrologer that my friends from college had been going to study with and having dinner with.
Oh, wow. So this was the person that everybody was driving down to New York City to take classes with?
Yes. So I got to meet her, a number of, not so many years later, let's see if that was in 1965, and I met her in 1973, about 7 or 8 years later, on the other side of the country.
Wow. Yeah, and so she just gave you this book for free, basically.
Yes.
And this is probably, I'm guessing, one of the first times you're really hearing about the asteroids or even considering it, right?
Right, the first time, because I had been quite isolated out in the commune of the wilds of Southern Oregon. So I took the book back, and then I couldn't go to the rest of the conference because of my young child. And we returned to Oregon, and I just started putting the asteroids in the charts because this really nice lady, the only person who really talked to me at the conference, gave me her book. And the only explanations about them were these small paragraphs she had in her book. No one had researched them yet because the ephemerides had just become available like within the last month of her publishing the book. And so when I would see the asteroids show up in the charts I was doing, I would say, I don't really know what this means, but let me just tell you the story. And of course, the stories were already inside of me from my childhood. So as I began to tell the stories, the people would say, oh my goodness, you've just told me the story of my life. And what I began to see, and this became the basis for all of the asteroid work that followed, that when a planetary body is significantly placed in the skies at the moment the person is born, the mythological story of the god or goddess who shares the same name as that planet becomes an overriding theme in the person's life. And people began to recognize what they previously had seen as unrelated incidents falling into the pattern of the mythic story, and that their life was an expression of these larger archetypal dramas that are the different stories, the plays, the scripts that humanity has available through which to live on our lives. So that revelation started to come about in the years after Eleanor had given me her book and I started working with the asteroids from the mythic perspective. But once again, I had no idea what was going on in the larger astrological community because we didn't have like any media happening there. and I didn't do traveling again for a while.
Okay. So basically then you during the second half of the 1970s, you're pretty much focused on continuing to do astrological research and consultations and especially focusing on the asteroids and researching those, but you're largely in isolation for several years?
By 1974, we left the commune and lived briefly in Portland. And while I was in Portland, Oregon, I took my first formal astrology classes with a teacher and with a group, and Virginia Dayan was my primary teacher at the Portland Astrology Center there. This is where I also met Diana Stone and Mark Robertson, a brilliant Seattle astrologer who died way too young, was another important figure teaching at that school. So I had some external contact. And everyone there was quite surprised about the asteroids because they hadn't made too much of an impression yet, although Zip Dobbins was working with them, as was Emma Bell Donath in the community. But from what I gathered, most of the regular community had dismissed them as orbiting gravel, I think they were called, and marginalized their importance. But because I wasn't connected with the larger community, I didn't have that filter of dismissing them.
Okay. So, and so during that time, you work out this sort of system in terms of how to determine which asteroids would become more prominent and which stories would become more prominent, and then also how to sort of deliver that information or present it as a delineation by focusing on the mythological story of that asteroid and the names associated with them.
Yes, and it was during this time I studied with Zip Dobbins and went to her intensives in Montana, connected with her children, Maritha Pottinger and Mark Pottinger, who are also very involved with their mother's work in the asteroids. They began to, Al Morrison and Lee Lehman then released ephemerides for another 7 or 8 minor asteroids that by this time I was plugged in enough to be able to receive them and put those in the chart. And I was teaching local astrology classes and starting to give some local presentations on the asteroids. Another important figure during this time was Tony Joseph, who was working in San Francisco with mythic astrology and the asteroids. And I had attended a few more conferences in the late 70s, early 80s that Tony had produced in San Francisco and was beginning to make more connections within the community. I remember, I'm guessing it was 1980-81 that I attended a conference put on by Stephen Arroyo in the Bay Area. And by this time, I had a whole body of information about the asteroids that was really exciting. It had been 8 or 9 years that I had been working with them at this point. And I had a conversation with one of, Arroyo had a publishing company with one of his editors. And I said, like, what should I do next with all this information? And he said, well, really, you need to write a book. He said, you can keep giving lectures, but the only people that are going to hear you are the 4 or 5 or 6 people that show up. Once you have a book, then you can reach a wider audience. So that gave me the realization that writing had to happen. At that time, I had also met Douglas Locke and Eugene, who is a wonderful writer who's excited about the project and was enthusiastic about collaborating with me, taking what I had to say and putting it into, whole sentences. When we completed the manuscript, I sent it to Stephen Royal's company, and they returned it saying, well, this is interesting, but no one here has any idea what asteroids are about, so we can't evaluate it at all. And at that point, I sent it to ACS, the publishing company that Neil Mikkelsen ran, because Maritha was one of his editors, and I had met Maritha through my attendance at her mother's intensives. And she read the manuscript, and she said, this is wonderful. We want to publish it. We don't think we're going to sell out of the first printing because it's like no one's interested in asteroids, but we think it's a worthwhile thing to publish. So we'll take it on. And the publication was done. The books were ready in June of 1986, 1 week before UAC. And in that interim week, there were some cancellations at UAC, and Neil Mikkelsen asked me if I would be willing to give a talk on the asteroids. I couldn't get paid or anything, but there was an opening, and I said, certainly. And so that's how we launched Asteroid Goddesses. I remember Douglas and I went to the conference, and we had a trade table. And we offered like free mini asteroid readings along with stacks of our books. And lots of people came, and we put the asteroids in their chart and spoke 5 or 6 minutes about them and then directed them to the bookstore. And Douglas has always been the marketing and business whiz of my book operation. Was thrilled that in that UAC, over 10% of the people who attended it walked home with a copy of Asteroid Goddesses.
What percent?
Over 10%.
Okay, wow. And this is like this is a huge conference because this is the first time.
Yeah, this is the very first UAC.
Okay.
So then Asteroid Goddesses is launched, and also my career as an astrologer officially gets launched as well.
Got it. So things really take off at that. And just to back up a minute, so you started writing Asteroid Goddesses in like 1980, 1981, right?
Yes. And I completed the manuscript in 1984. Douglas had a health issue for about a year, so he was out of commission. And we've had a remarkably wonderful writing relationship because he was able to understand what I was trying to say and then put it in language that actually expressed that thought. And I learned to write from Douglas by, you know, he would do a word by word, line by line editing of my sentences. And then I'd have to turn them, go back into the computer and rewrite them. And in that process, I began to see how sentences and paragraphs were constructed and how one kept a structure and cohesion of themes.
Okay. So, and he's been somebody that you've worked with on all of your books at this point, right?
Yes, in one way or another, he's been an element. But I remember, so Asteroid Goddesses is published. It's 1986. Mm-hmm. My children are in like grade school now, both of them, and I'm thinking that I need to have a real job, and that maybe my like debt to astrology has been completed with this book. So I have this idea of becoming a computer programmer, as some of my friends in San Francisco were now being and making great money. And I knew that I had the mind or the math background. So I took, you know, examinations, and I passed them fine, and I applied to computer school and got accepted. And I was walking out of the bank with my financial loan papers in my hand and walked smack into a glass wall and got a brain concussion and was unable to start this program of staring at computer screens 9 hours a day for the next 9 months. So the computer career like rapidly fell apart. And in the interim, Douglas and I began writing Astrology for Yourself. that then was published a year later.
In 1987.
And initially we published that book as a self-published venture. We had one of those old dot matrix printers that we, you know, put on like really good print, and I did all of the graphics on simple McDraw programs. And
right.
Right. And we, one of our funniest stories is that we're photocopying like, you know, 250 pages at Kinko's and collating it. And he's gone to get our covers from someone else who printed them and bring them back to Kinko's so we can bind them up. But that sealer wasn't put on the covers and all the ink is smudging and smearing all over the place.
Oh, no.
So then, like, we take all the covers out to Kinko's parking lot with fixative spray, and we're spraying them and then running back inside and getting the stuff off the photocopy machines and bringing them to the binder machine. And, you know, at the end of a very crazy day, we have 250 copies of our new book. And a few days later, you know, I pack them into boxes and go to San Francisco to give some lectures and to see if we can sell the books.
And yeah, the 1980s was, on the one hand, I'm sure, a very like exciting time in terms of self-publishing and stuff.
Right.
But it was kind of a dark time for like typography in books with some of those dot matrix printers.
Right, right. I know. So I give a talk one night and I sell, you know, 5 or 6 copies of the book, and that's exciting. And Douglas calls me early the next morning. He says, I just realized book people, distributing companies in the Bay Area, and they also have a small publishing house. So why don't you call them up and see if they're interested in distributing our book? I said, okay. So I call them up and I say, hi, blah, blah, blah. And they said, oh, yeah, we know all about your book and we're interested in publishing it. And I go, how do you know about our book? Oh, someone who works for us was at your talk last night and they brought it back to the office and we're all standing around it, oohing and aahing. And so can we be your publishers? And we go, sure. So.
And what publisher was this?
This was Wingbo. That was the publishing arm of Book People Distributors, who was then servicing all of the metaphysical New Age books around the country.
Okay. So they pick it up that same year in 1987?
Right. And then that gets published within the year.
And was that a successful book, or how did that go?
It's been our most successful book of everything that I've written. And I think even that Douglas has written another 20 books of his own, not on astrology topics, but on affirmations and positive and self-help and healing and mental illness and things. But of all our books, Astrology for Yourself has been the most consistent bestseller through the more than 30 years now that it's been around.
Right. And it's like currently, I think it's published by Ibis Press, right?
Yes, it is. And it was a workbook on how to interpret your own chart as a program text and filling in the blanks. And so we found that many, and this was another like brilliant idea of Douglas's in collaboration with Wingbo. He found out who was teaching astrology all over the country and then had Wingbo send these teachers free copies of our book. And with that began to implant the book as being a major teaching tool for astrology teachers, who we've gotten wonderful feedback from over the years that it totally accelerated their students' learning capacities in the study of the subject.
Yeah, it's really unique and stands out in that regard, is that it's an actual workbook where you fill in the blanks about your own chart rather than just being something that's entirely exposition.
Yes. And I remember once giving a talk in somewhere in the Midwest, and there were when I went around the group asking who are you, what are your interests in astrology, there were two Catholic nuns that were there, And I said, like, what are you doing here? And one of them said, oh, well, I got a copy of your book, Astrology for Yourself. And I've been doing the charts of all of the nuns in our convent. So that was another beautiful piece of seeing how far out it went. They, we began to receive letters from people in prison, hearing about our book and asking if we could send them copies. And, I don't know, in the course of my life, maybe 50 or more books I've personally sent out to request from prisons, as that word went around different prisons, that you could get this astrology book that was like very cool. And then we would like sometimes get their data and send them charts. So that book has had a wonderful life. I also heard it made its way to the Eastern Bloc countries before the wall came down. And there were written copies of it in the Ukraine and other parts of Russia while the wall was still up. So it's had like a remarkable life in many different areas.
And do you feel like, did that reaffirm sort of your commitment that you could make it in that career after almost going into becoming a programmer? Or where were you at in terms of sort of committal to astrology as like a full-time career at that point?
Well, you know, I never thought, oh, I want to become an astrologer. And how do I go about doing this? Mm-hmm. It was just something that happened to me. And I grew up with it along with raising my children. And at a certain point, I was receiving requests for readings and realizing, oh, I was actually generating an income that was helping me pay my expenses. And then I don't know if there was any point that I said, oh, I guess like I'm a professional astrologer now, but it was just something that was in fact what I was doing.
Sure. Okay. So, but this sort of, begins a pretty decent stretch of maybe the busiest part of your career from the late 1980s through the early 1990s, where it seems like you were very active and did a lot of consulting and teaching and conferences and things like that, right?
Yes. Quite a bit. Invitations came to teach all over the world. And because the astrological community was still ambivalent about the asteroids, but the women's spirituality community was wide open to them, I did a lot of work in that area as well, and using the format of Astrology for Yourself for people who did not know astrology, would never become astrologers, but were curious about how the goddess archetypes influenced and impacted their life. And that was the heyday of the goddess movement. And so a lot of my work went out into the larger community. And there was a piece that I understand that trying to convince the astrologers at the top to integrate the asteroids almost seemed futile at a certain point, futile. Because they had their system and it worked for them and they didn't need anything else to clutter and confuse it. But I also understood that if I disseminated the material at the grassroots, then all of these people would eventually be going to the astrologers saying, hey, what about the asteroids in my chart? And that's what would motivate them to give them a second look. So it was working sort of from the bottom up rather than the top down. And so the work was really widespread, going way beyond the astrological community itself.
Sure. But this wasn't something that happened overnight. It was really much more of a gradual
Right. It was a gradual thing. And then all the tours to the sacred sites in the Mediterranean started happening in the early 90s.
And what was that?
Well, having another business as a tour leader and creating itineraries to the sacred sites in Greece and having people come on these trips and having their charts of all the asteroids of the gods and goddesses of the sites that we travel to in their charts, and doing personal ritual work around that became another way of disseminating the material and connecting back with, you know, my roots in classical antiquity.
Okay. So you start to bring together some of those different pieces again for things like that.
Yeah. And I've done, since the 1990s, probably 15 to 18 tours to Greece. And some of those included Turkey. I did astrological tour to Egypt, to India, and this past year to Italy. So, it's also integrating the mythic dimension of astrology with place, with history, with archaeology, with meditation.
Okay. So you're doing those tours, and then by 1992, you released another book, Mysteries of the Dark Moon. Mm-hmm. And what was the focus of that?
That was a book that was published by HarperCollins. It wasn't an astrology book per se, but all of it came out of my astrological studies, and that was looking at the dark phase of the moon and cyclic process. And I explored it from a mythic point of view, a psychological point of view, a spiritual point of view, of the dark phase being one of closure and transition and renewal. And then that was followed by Finding Our Way Through the Dark, which was the astrology that was connected with Mysteries of the Dark Moon, that looked into the 12th house and the dark goddess asteroids and the progressed lunation cycle and the progressed dark moon phase. And also the nodes, I think, and there was a little bit of eclipses. And that was also set up as a workbook as well.
Okay, so this was like a specific, almost like phase during the early to mid 1990s, where you're focusing on a certain like set of topics, almost.
It was, you know, the mandala of the asteroid goddesses, all arise from the moon, as laying underneath them, the moon being the essence of the feminine principle, and the asteroids being the main differentiations of that, and so. It seemed to me that looking at the base, the ground of the feminine, which is the moon, that she deserved her own treatment.
So this is kind of like the culmination in some sense of a lot of that work. I think that you've called this before, like your goddess phase.
Yeah.
Okay. So by this point, we're getting into the mid 1990s, and you'd been thinking about going back to school possibly for a while. I guess initially maybe through that other career as a programmer, but decided not to follow through with it. But then some other stuff started happening that made you reconsider that again, or maybe, I guess, there were some events that happened prior to that maybe that we should touch on first.
Right. Well, I always thought about going back to school because I have a Gemini moon, and going to school is like the most fun thing I can think of doing. And it seems at that point, of course, modern humanistic psychological astrology was what was happening. It was the main kind of astrology. And there was a lot of emphasis on counseling astrology and of having the proper skills and credentials to be able to do that. So that was in the back of my mind of trying to get those credentials. And I was living at this point, I had been living on the Oregon coast since 1974, 75, and raising my children. And there was a brief opportunity when maybe I was going to move to Eugene with my daughter and enroll at the University of Oregon, and sent out some initial query level letters, but then that didn't work out and that wasn't going to happen, and we were still going to remain on the coast. So that there was a notion of that didn't really come to any kind of fruition. And I'm thinking that must have been around 1989.
Okay. And then there was a similar foreshadowing with some of the Hellenistic stuff that started happening around like 1992, 1993, right?
Right. And this is, for me, continues to be one of the mind-boggling experiences of my life. On one of the trips to Greece, I had met a woman who had done psychotherapy and regression, and I was really impressed with the groundedness of who she was and her work. So in April of 1993, I was in New York. My mother lived in New York, and so I was there every year at least once or more to visit her. But I decided to make an appointment with and to have this regression. And my question was, like, why I'd forgotten my knowledge of the Greek language and what I might have to do to reclaim it. And having come off now two or three tours to Greece, you know, you have these fantasies. Oh, well, I'm going to like go into a past life and be like a priestess from Delphi. But what happened instead is the sequence of images that came to me was of this young girl born on the west coast of the British Isles during the 1600s, and whose grandfather was like a celestial navigator, and that he created charts for the navigators to use based on stellar positions. And through his influence, I got some education at a nearby abbey where I learned Latin and Greek. And this must have been before Henry shut all the abbeys down, because there were some that were, apparently were still open. And then I ended up as a young woman being in some city, being involved in the translation of astrological texts from Latin and Greek into English. And my life was just like sitting in this room with, you know, having a family and having a husband, and just whenever I could working on translating. And that was the end of the regression. And I said, well, that was really interesting, but what does that have to do with anything?
Right. Cause I had no relevance to your present life.
So, but it was revealed like very quickly. From New York, I went to Boston to teach for the MCGR. And on the coffee table of my hostess was Rob Hand's first pamphlet on Arhat for the retrieval of the ancient text. And I go, oh, isn't this interesting? Like, this is just what I went through the last, like, 2 days ago.
So this is literally the same month right after you had the regression?
This is, like, in less than a week. This is, like, 3 days later.
Okay.
And then I finished my teachings in Boston and flew directly to Norwalk to be part of the conference there. And that was the conference at which Rob Hand and Robert Schmidt formally announced Project Hindsight. And they asked for subscribers. And so I went, oh, I guess I have some sort of connection here. And so I, you know, said, okay, I'll subscribe to your project. And, you know, it turned out that I was the very first subscriber to the project. So at that moment, whatever the themes of the regression were manifested within 2 weeks of making the connection with what would then become like the next major theme in my life. It wouldn't actually happen for a while yet, but that was the inception point.
Sure. And you became literally the first subscriber to this translation project that was just starting at that time.
Yes.
Which then hundreds of other astrologers would subsequently subscribe to it. And it would become this big community effort, but you just happened to, you know, because of that motivation of having just had that regression, went and signed up right away.
Exactly.
All right. So, and that's something that was just getting going at that point. So they announced it at Norwalk in May of 1993. And then they also, I guess, they would start publishing some of those translations that you would then receive, and then they'd also start having conferences or conclaves over the next few years, right?
Yes. And I, like everyone else at that time, were excited to get the publications, but when we opened them up, we had no idea what they were saying. Even though they were in English, they might as well have been in Greek for all the sense that they made to us. And the conclaves were really exciting. But again, there was like, it was a completely different language altogether. And I was still, this is the mid-90s, I was still very much involved with the asteroids, the myth, the feminist material. But I remember right in this time period, there was a AFA conference in Chicago. I think it was 1994. And that was the first time that I met Zoller, Robert Zoller. And in some conversation we had afterwards at the gathering, when he found out I was an astrologer and I hadn't read Claudius Ptolemy, he started screaming at me that I should be ashamed of myself. How could any self-respecting astrologer call them that? And not having read Ptolemy, and it was like a shock to me of like getting a barrage of that kind of like scolding, shaming, negative energy from someone I had just met. You know, afterwards we realized, oh, that's just typical Zoller personality, but it definitely made an impression. We see here now we're at like going to some conclaves, being aware of the translations that are coming out through Project Hindsight, developing some friendships with Robert Schmidt, with Ellen Black, with Robert Zoller, with Rob, who had always been one of, you know, my heroes in terms of following his lead. And by the mid-late 1990s, my children were grown and they were in their own lives. And I had been waiting for the opportunity to go back to school. And now it seemed like it was time. And so, I wasn't ready to leave Oregon, but the University of Oregon was in Eugene. So I moved from the Oregon coast to Eugene and enrolled in the classics program. Because at that point, I still thought I would be continuing my mythological interests. I felt I had almost reached a platform of having gone as far as I could in my studies in mythology, and I needed more skills or tools or resources. And the classics department seemed like it was the closest to that. So I enrolled in the summer of 1997. And then it was, well, the requirements for this degree are you have to learn to read Latin and Greek. This is just what we do here. And I said, okay. And so that then started me on the process of learning the ancient languages.
Okay. So you literally from scratch at that point learned Latin and ancient Greek. And even given, you know, having learned modern Greek as a child and then forgotten it, even that would have really no help in terms of learning ancient Greek because they're so different, right?
Right. And that's true. They're completely different. But I also remember in the regression, like, what do I have to do to get my knowledge of the language back? And now, like, 15 years later, I'm in graduate school, like, learning the language. So again, that was another kind of foreshadowing that of that pivotal regression.
Right. So now you find yourself, and that was, I mean, a little bit haphazard on some level in that you wanted to go back to school and you wanted to focus on mythology. And so you asked, you know, what would I take in order to do that? And they said classics.
Right.
And so you were kind of like, you know, okay, sign me up for that then. But maybe at the beginning, you didn't realize the full enormity of like what that was going to entail in order to get a classics degree, right? Or did you, in terms of having to learn all those languages and how?
I didn't realize how hard learning all those languages is going to be and what a huge commitment of total focus and energy it would entail.
Sure.
I had no idea of the enormity of what I was signing up for. But because, like, I love being a student, it was a thrilling adventure at the same time.
Sure. So, and you focus on that, and this also takes you back so that you end up focusing a lot more on history and learning the history of ancient astrology and things like that at the same time.
What I'm learning, what my other courses are, of course, ancient Greek history, ancient Roman history, historiography. I started taking a lot of ancient Greek and Roman art classes. And just the general requirements for the classics degree. And when I was asked, you know, before I was accepted as a graduate student, what my motivation was, I said, oh, just personal enrichment. I didn't have any illusions because my, you know, advisor said, you know, we don't offer a PhD program here. And I said, that's fine. I don't want a PhD. He said, so you're not thinking that you're going to take this degree and go out and get a job as a professor in, you know, academia. I said, no, that's not my program. I just like want to do this because I want to do this. Right. And he said, great. That's what I needed to hear because I don't want to give you any illusions about anything else at this point.
Right.
So that's how it started. And I remember the first year being relatively quiet about my astrological interests of just taking everything that I knew and sort of putting it on the shelf and completely emptying my mind to receiving what was being taught. And I had heard stories of other astrologers going into graduate programs, and once they found out they were astrologers, they began to have a difficult time with being marginalized by their professors. So I thought I would just like hold that private. But by the second year, enough of my fellow classmates had figured out what I was doing, and it trickled to my faculty members who were okay with it. And especially because halfway through, and again, I'm so curious that all of this was going on as like the transit of Neptune was opposing my sun. It hardly seems like under a Neptune transit, I would be hearing this intense language learning, but that was what was happening. Kepler College had gotten its authorization. They were looking for teachers. They had heard on the grapevine that I would have a master's degree in a few years in classics, which they needed, which was the right kind of degree for their first year history program. And they asked me if I would consider joining their faculty when I got my degree. So this was like totally amazing. I had no idea that when I went into the program that this was anywhere a possibility for me. But once I let my professors know that I had a job waiting for me, they were so wildly enthusiastic. Because part of the success of their program is to place their students. And so they said, okay, we've got to get you ready for this. So everyone came on board to support my writing, whatever paper I had to write about anything, of focusing it on the history and transmission of the ancient sciences, of astrology, of astronomy, so that I could start developing the background to be able to teach what I would be expected to. So much of the lessons that I gave at Kepler College on the history of ancient astrology were developed under the supervision of my academic professors who helped me be clear around the sources and the verification and the arguments and all of that. So it was such an amazingly fortunate experience that I had.
And it was something unique because, I mean, and that's one of the reasons Kepler contacted and would have been interested in you, because you would have been one of the few people in the community, to have a master's degree, let alone, or even, you know, there's even fewer people with PhDs, but also to have that background, especially in the history and transmission of astrology, and especially in the classical period.
Yeah.
So you do that. You eventually, as part of your master's thesis, you do a translation of a Byzantine text, right?
Yes. Manuel I Comnenus was a Byzantine emperor who was an advocate of astrology. He was in the 12th century, which was just when all of the translations were coming into southern Spain from the Arab world and being translated. So he was part of that larger movement. And there was a monk who complained to the patriarch that, hey, our emperor is into astrology, and this is against the Bible and religion, and don't you think you should do something about it? So when the patriarch approached him, Manuel decided to write a Christian defense of astrology that then was had its refutation by one of his arch enemies, another theologian, Michael Glycus. But these two texts had never been translated into English or into any other language beside their original composition in ancient Byzantine Greek. So that's what I translated for my thesis work.
Okay. And that ended up getting, that was accepted, and you got your master's.
Right. And I got, yeah.
And that was also published in Culture and Cosmos, right?
Mm-hmm. And now I see it being included in academic bibliographies and footnoted in academic books. And I'm sure those individuals have no idea who I am or what my background is, but somehow it's made its way into the world of academic footnotes.
Sure. which is a very wide world.
Yeah.
Okay. So you finish you get your master's degree, and pretty much immediately Kepler happens to open at the same time.
Right.
And they
graduate in June of 2000. Mm-hmm. And Kepler opens its doors in July of 2000.
So it's just like this miraculous sort of coincidence, right, that you're sort of like in the right place with the right training and degree. And then that's right when Kepler starts. And Kepler itself was like this 10-year project that had been building up since the late 80s and early 90s. But especially they incorporated in 1992, which is itself interesting because that's the same time that Project Hindsight started, and a lot of the other stuff that we were talking about earlier. Yeah. Your regression was not far after that, 1993. But so Kepler then, after many years of trying to build up and create an accredited school for astrology, actually opens in the summer of 2000. Mm-hmm. So you were one of the main faculty, I guess, during that first class of students.
Right. It was Rob, Hand, and the Campion, and myself who started the first year history program. And Lee Lehman also, by the latter part of that year, became one of the team members.
And that first year was entirely teaching the students the history of astrology from,
yes,
the ancient period all the way up through modern times?
Yes.
Okay. So you're teaching the first class of students. It's in the school year is divided into three parts, and they had three in the middle, I guess, of each of these three semesters that are each year. All the students would fly out to Seattle and all the teachers in order to meet for like a week long week of like lectures and intensives, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. And it was like those were amazing, amazing events where there was such a coming together in such an intense way of the learning of our history and tradition. And I remember the very first symposium, like we hadn't done it before. We didn't have like any boundaries. And I remember Rob being like so thrilled that he could teach as long as he wanted the stuff that he was like wildly interested in. It was like 10:30 at night and we're still in the classroom.
Right. So this isn't just some short, you know, conference, 75-minute lectures. This
Right. And, you know, then everyone would gather after hours and keep talking about what we had learned and discussing it until the wee hours of the morning. And then we'd start all over again. It was like really exciting and stimulating and one of the peak experiences of the career.
Sure. So towards the end of that first school year, so you're completing the last year of or the last semester of the first year of Kepler students. It's the spring of 2001, and they decide to have the symposium where everybody flies out for the third term or the third semester, the final semester of that year, at the very end of it, they all fly out for the symposium and they have it coincide with the annual conference that takes place every year in Seattle, which is the Northwest Astrology Conference in May of 2001, right?
Yes.
Okay. And I've heard this story from like a few different perspectives, but this ended up being kind of a pivotal event, again, in your career as well as for many other people, because I mean, I guess I can let you tell this story, but you and the Kepler students, you finished the symposium and now it's after that and you guys have transitioned into attending this astrology conference, and all the Kepler students are attending lectures during the course of the week for this annual conference, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. And right, and Project Hindsight sends their representatives to have a booth, a table in the trade show. And Alan White was there. I think Bill Johnson was there. And one or two other people whose names I can't recall. And I had met both Bill and Alan at previous conclaves that had happened in the mid-1990s. I may have even seen, and I believe that I had seen them at a UAC that was somewhere in the middle of that. But then they show up, you know, hi, great to see you. We didn't know that you'd be here. They set up their Project Hindsight booth, and then they start talking Hellenistic astrology. And Alan offers to give a free after-hours lecture on Friday night. And so our students are saying to us, well, what's this Hellenistic astrology stuff about? And I'm going, oh, yeah, we've been teaching you about the history of astrology in the ancient time period. But there's all this work that's being done now in the translation and reconstruction of it. So a number of us went to Alan's lecture and we were just like simply blown away. It was so amazing. And they announced that Robert Schmidt would be giving a week-long intensive in Cumberland, Maryland, the following month. And I realized that I had to go to it, partially because I couldn't be teaching at Kepler and having my students ask me about this and not knowing what to say to them, but also because I was a supporter of Hindsight. And in the intervening years of my college focus, I'd blocked out a lot of my astrological connections because I just couldn't do both. So it was also to reconnect and to see what Bob had done with the material since the last time I had a chance to speak with him.
Sure. And that lecture, and the other funny thing about the lecture is the way I had heard part of it is that it was kind of like you guys were all at the bar one night and Alan was sort of spouting off about Hellenistic astrology in this really gruff, you know, former army sort of ex-military guy type style. And everybody sort of encouraged him to give a lecture about it. And then he gives this impromptu, he pulls out this famous flip chart.
The flip chart.
Right, which has a bunch of diagrams that he's made that are kind of quirky, but like pack a lot of information about some of the core principles of Hellenistic astrology. And so he gives this impromptu lecture. He's not scheduled to give his own talk, and there's no other talks in Hellenistic astrology at this conference, but he gives this impromptu talk with this flip chart that he pulls out of nowhere in an empty room, and all of the Kepler students are dazzled and, you know, ask you, you know, if this is something that's going to be taught in upcoming courses at Kepler. And at that point, it was not, or it wouldn't have been at that point, right?
Right. At this point, it was not on the curriculum.
Okay. So... Right.
Because, like, it really hadn't even been anything yet. I mean, Bob was in the process of translating these texts, but it wasn't as if it was a area of astrology that had been presented at lectures and conferences and so on. It was still totally new in the making.
Right. And it seems like one of the other issues that a lot of astrologers, because I keep hearing this from different astrologers that were in the community at that time in the mid-90s, that there was a lot of excitement, a lot of support over Project Hindsight when it first came out, and everybody subscribed to the subscription service. But then it's like you get the translations and they're so radically different from the way that astrology is practiced today, and that the technical terminology is so foreign that you almost couldn't do anything with it, that you needed like a translator to translate the translation. Or exactly. In some instance, even the guys that were translating it were not, you know, they were very good at talking about astrology in a very high level, but sometimes they needed translators. And in some way, that's the role that Alan served in that lecture, is that suddenly you guys got a lecture that had all of the core principles of Hellenistic astrology in this really concise, understandable fashion in 2001. So I'm sure that would have been really, really appealing. And so you decide to go out there that summer for that intensive the very next month.
Right. Before I get to that, I just want to say, I remember, you know, in the year or two before that, once like being so frustrated with Rob, I said, okay, Rob, but what does this mean? Like, how do you use it in the chart? Like, why aren't you telling us that as, you know, a subscriber? And he would say, we don't know what it means yet. We're just like discovering what it is that's in the text. Like, you know, give us a break here.
Right.
In July of 2001, I go to Cumberland. I go to the week-long intensive. And I sometimes say in that week, my whole astrology career, like, totally crumbled like a house of cards.
So this was the Einstein intensives at Project Hindsight?
Yeah. And I realized that I would need to totally rebuild the foundation of my own astrological understanding and process.
Sure.
And it was like wonderful, but it really entailed like starting all over again from the very beginning. And even, you know, Bob talking at that point, he was doing the Einstein intensives, but there were concepts floating about that I had no idea what they were. I remember this is where I first met Nick Dagan Best, and he had attended the intensive that had been given 2 weeks before, and he was still at the house for the second one. And during like the breaks, I'd say, Nick, like, what did he just say?
So this is Robert Schmidt, who's one of the principal founders of Project Hindsight. Right. And at that point, he was the only person sort of, since after splitting up with Robert Zoller, originally he was part of the project leaving in the mid-90s, and then Robert Hand leaving in 1997, 1998. So this is now 2001, and Robert Schmidt has done enough of the translations that he thinks he's got a sort of preliminary reconstruction of the system together of how Hellenistic astrology was practiced. And so he's presenting it by doing this weekend-long workshop where he throws all of the techniques at one chart, at the chart of Albert Einstein. So, and this is evidently sort of impressive enough and interesting enough to you that you feel like you have to really reorient your entire approach to astrology in order to incorporate this information, which is you want to incorporate, but you realize is going to involve reconstructing your ideas of astrology from the ground up.
Absolutely. And the exciting part is thinking, what a fortunate time to be born in, that for the first time in 2000 years, we had access to the ways that our tradition was originally conceptualized and conceived and practiced, that no other astrologers have had this access in the interim, like all of this stuff at once. And what a shame to be an astrologer now and not to learn what our own tradition is all about, and how fortunate to have the opportunity to do so. And I guess after having like gone through the incredible process of learning the ancient languages, it was like, okay, it's like more of the same, only, you know, yet another language.
Sure. And that's a really interesting point. That's kind of like ironic or interesting that you could go through and study, you know, the history of ancient astrology really deeply and get your master's thesis in it. Yet in terms of understanding the practice of ancient astrology, that on some level is almost like a much different thing than just studying the history, but that studying and understanding the actual techniques is a little bit different of a beast.
So So that happens in July. We go back for a second year at Kepler, and we're at the Fall Symposium, and Kepler's second year. And Kathy Coleman had just come on as the new Kepler president. And Dennis Harness was invited as the guest lecturer for that term, because in the winter term, Dennis was slated to teach Vedic astrology. And I'm saying we've got to put Hellenistic astrology on our curriculum. I said, it's ridiculous to teach our students a whole year about the history of astrology, and now that we have the actual practice and techniques, not to teach them about that, and instead to be teaching them about Vedic astrology. It's like, conceptually, it doesn't make sense. And because Kathy Coleman and Dennis Harness had both been together at CIIS, where they got their PhDs, which was East-West Studies.
So that's the California Institute of Integral Studies.
Right, where they're integrating Eastern and Western traditions. Dennis says, well, I think that you should do the Hellenistic along with the Vedic. We can co-teach it together, and that's how we'll make space for the Hellenistic material. And Kathy, who's now the president, says, that's a terrific idea. I approve it.
Okay. So that's like the fall or summer of 2001?
That's the fall of 2001.
Okay.
So then it's like, if I'm going to be teaching this. Oh, yeah, and I guess it was slated to be taught in the springtime. It's like, what am I going to teach?
Right.
Right.
So now you've got to study. And
Now I've got to get it together, so to speak. So I make plans to spend the winter of 2001-2002 in the area where Robert Schmidt and Alan White live. And Alan White hosted me to stay with him. We did an intensive bunch of months where unit by unit, he would teach me. I would take notes. I would try to write them up. He would look at them and correct them. We'd send them at the pages to Bob. Bob would go through it, make his additions and corrections. I'd do the final changes. They both look it over. And okay, we have the first lesson. And then we went through that for the 9 more. So we had 10 lessons for the course. And so with that, I was able to then show up spring term and have a course to teach. And I have to really acknowledge the transmission that came from Robert Schmidt, that all of what I had done at that point was through him being my teacher and the incredibly essential role that Alan White played. And stepping down Smith's teachings one notch so that I could understand them and repeat them back and have them corrected, and for him to work with me in that very close way to make sure what I was writing was in fact what I was supposed to be and what was being said. And I'd also like to acknowledge Mark Kunzel during this period, because he lived nearby and he would come and visit, and he created a lot of the initial diagrams that we used in that course to be able to further help the students understand what was going on. So it was a collaborative effort of a number of people that happened during that winter.
Sure. That sounds like an incredible opportunity to be able to go out there. And so Robert Schmidt and what is essentially Project Hindsight was in Cumberland, Maryland, and then Alan lived about an hour away in yes. West Virginia, right?
Yes. And we travel there like once or twice a week.
Okay. So you've got it, and everything sort of comes together at that point, because then suddenly all of your background in ancient history and ancient Greek and everything else sort of comes in handy or becomes relevant, because at this point you're finally learning the full technical apparatus of ancient astrology and sort of understanding, I don't want to say how powerful, because that sounds like a weird way to frame it, but how sort of special that sort of system of astrology was that came together at that time that then is transmitted over the past 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you end up taking back to Kepler, and you begin teaching the course on Hellenistic astrology there for the first time in the spring of 2002.
Yes. And to say that it was an evolving process, because we're all like, it was in the process of being figured out. So there would be a certain set of lessons, and the next time around, Bob would say, oh, well, I think I understand this a little bit better. Could you change this way? And so each year the lessons became more refined and subtly altered. And it was my ability to know the Greek words and to look up stuff in the lexicon that helped me better be able to transmit what was going on.
Yeah, and that ended up becoming incredibly important, because it then combined, you know, this incredibly high level work, this conceptual and linguistic and historical and other technical work that's going on with the astrology, but then some of your previous experience as a teacher and as somebody that has always had an interest in breaking things down and sort of a gift for making them understandable to students, and obviously showing a focus on that with earlier books like Astrology for Yourself, then really come into play here, where you're able to take this incredibly dense, complicated material and then attempt to present it in an understandable fashion to this group of second year students at Kepler. Mm-hmm. And that program is also unique because it's not just presented as a Hellenistic astrology course on its own, but it's taught side by side with an introduction to Indian or Vedic astrology with Dennis Harness at the same time.
Right. And what we began to see was the incredible similarities between the Hellenistic and the Vedic. And in some ways, Hellenistic is closer to the Vedic than it is to the modern. Very exciting for all of us as well. So it was a very rich, multicultural, multidimensional learning experience.
Okay.
Right. So you should say a few words now about how you entered into the Kepler program shortly after that.
Sure. So, I mean, I guess you started teaching that in spring of 2002. So I showed up for in late 2004. So what, you've been teaching it, you've taught it twice already. So I come in the third iteration of that course, and I start taking it in December of 2004, and I'm really annoyed because I went to Kepler with the intention of learning psychological astrology, and then I was supposed to be able to do that once you get to the second year, and then you're supposed to break off to your specific track to study the techniques after you've done a year of history. And I came in halfway through the history year, starting with the medieval period, so I accidentally skipped the ancient, especially the Greco-Roman history piece, which consequently made me even less interested in studying Hellenistic astrology once I got to the second year. But they basically told me I didn't have a choice, despite my protests and some of my other students in my class's protests. So they made us take it, but it really quickly, within what we got was, on the one hand, this book called The Source Book, which was a compilation. It was about 150 pages of excerpts of different translations with a little bit of commentary from the ancient astrologers by Robert Schmidt that was sent directly from Project Hindsight. And then we got this other publication, which was your lecture notes and your teaching notes, which really it sort of expounded upon the translations that we're looking at, but also really translated. It literally translated the translation and made all of the stuff understandable. And with it, it only took me about a week or two before I realized that a lot of my misconceptions or preconceptions about ancient forms of astrology were misplaced, and that there was something really valuable there to learn. So I got really, really into it. So, and this is, I guess, you've already been teaching it for a couple of years at that point. So I'm sure I came in at a great time where it was much more refined than whatever the first or even second version of the class was.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So were teaching Hellenistic astrology there and learning it there. And one of the things that was interesting from my perspective is that that became sort of the most interesting and most exciting and most pivotal course. And I think for a lot of Kepler students, that became one of the most exciting and interesting courses. That's not to downplay. I mean, there's still a lot of other interesting and great material that was being taught there. But one of the things that I think dismayed a lot of people who had supported Kepler that were sort of, you know, in the broader astrological community and sort of observing from the sidelines about what was going on is that suddenly you had people like me that go in as modern astrologers, but then sort of come out of the Kepler program, you know, raving about ancient astrology and older forms of astrology in general, and that being becoming either their main focus or having incorporated a lot of concepts from that. And I think that's a hard thing to explain how that happened or why that happened without having that experience. But I'm sure it was something that was a little bit weird or dismaying to some people that were watching from the outside. Yeah, but that was happening not just with Hellenistic astrology, but with Indian astrology and other approaches as well, like horary or...
Horary, right. Lee and Rob were both teaching medieval and horary astrology. So, and our history of astrology, we're also teaching all of the practices and techniques of those historical periods. And people were becoming very excited about what they were learning because that information simply hadn't been available to us previously. When I first went into astrology, I thought that modern astrology, this is the way it had always been done. And it was such a shock to realize that, no, that wasn't true at all. And then to discover the rich tradition that lay before our contemporary understanding, which is not to discredit the value of modern astrology. I still work a lot with counseling and with psychological issues, and I'm still using 500 asteroids in my charts. But I have the foundation piece that is the ancient traditional, that everything else then has a steady ground to be built upon.
Sure. Yeah, and just that time at Kepler in general was just an amazing period where you had so many of like the people that were at the top of their respective approaches to astrology or the top of the field that were presenting, you know, the accumulated research of everything they'd been doing for decades of their life, and all the students were receiving it and getting this great coverage of all of the different traditions and the history and the philosophy and the techniques and just about everything. So it was this really unique, sort of beautiful thing for that sort of relatively short period of time in the mid-2000s. So eventually you ended up leaving Kepler by, what, 2006 or so?
Yes.
Okay. And one of the first things that you did after that that's always been really interesting to me is you kind of brought together all of the different threads of your previous astrological career up to that point with your next book, which was Astrology and the Authentic Self, which was published in 2008, where it becomes one of the first books, I think, that represents a true synthesis or an attempt to synthesize ancient and modern astrology into a new system of sorts. And that was your goal with the book more, or was that your goal with the book more or less?
Right. Well, in some ways, the book was an outgrowth of some of the reasons that I left Kepler. By 2006, the school was having financial problems, administrative problems, and also becoming very frustrated in its attempt to get accredited. And because the school was trying to get a liberal arts accreditation, it couldn't become a vocational school. And so we couldn't really, we could teach about astrology or about the historical approach to charts, but there was this way in which we're not supposed to teach about the contemporary practice of astrology. But by the fourth year, our students were like desperate for like, how do you actually read a chart? And I was trying to, what I eventually became Astrology and the Authentic Self, I was at that point trying to synthesize into fourth year programs but there was pressure that that wasn't permissible during our attempt for accreditation because we couldn't be teaching vocational astrology. So there were a number of reasons that left to my weaving, and part of it was, in retrospect, trying to get this other body of work into manifestation that I couldn't fully engage in while I was teaching there.
Right.
And in many ways, that book, Astrology and the Authentic Self, was written for my Kepler students with them in mind. They were my audience. And it was as if I could teach you what I want to teach you at this point in your education, this is what it would be.
Right, because some of those issues with, on the one hand, Kepler's attempt to get accreditation and need to therefore use like euphemisms for astrology instead of saying astrology, or just teach it from a historical perspective and not as more of a practical thing, so that some of the issues students had then in leaving it was that they were very good with some academic aspects of talking about astrology, but didn't necessarily know like how to set up a practice, or especially one of the issues was how to, once you've been presented with all these many different traditions of astrology, either, you know, how to settle on one to go with, or how to synthesize different aspects of what you've learned so that they're not necessarily conflicting, but instead they're working together in a way that is interesting and sort of useful and valuable in a consulting setting. And that idea of dealing with actual clients and working in a consulting setting seems to be part of, or a large part of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, you know, I'd say I left Kepler in 2006, but I wasn't complete with what I wanted to communicate as part of the Kepler era until 2008, when that book was finally published.
Sure. And then by that point, it's like Kepler's academic program sort of failed. They lost the ability to grant degrees, and the whole sort of experiment itself ended and sort of imploded on itself after 10 years anyways. But part of the result of that still, of you leaving at that point, was being able to put that book out, and that acting as one of the first true, I think, attempts to synthesize the modern and ancient traditions in recent times. So after that point, you continued your research and your focus on Hellenistic astrology and on the reconstruction of Hellenistic astrology, right?
Right, and I have taken on quite a few private students that I've brought through the program of learning Hellenistic astrology. I've done it on a one-to-one mentor coaching basis, so that we work with charts that the student supplies, the people they know, and I do like a teaching and show them how to work it with the charts they have. And then ask them to go back and talk to the people and to see how this matches their experiences. And then to come back with yet another chart and replicate the process for me, so I can track that they, in fact, understand how to use the concept correctly, and help them in that process before moving on to the next one. And so in that, I have like refined even more and more my own understanding and teaching approach. And so now I'm in the process of writing the Hellenistic astrology workbook in a similar way to the Astrology for Yourself workbook, where after the teaching, there's many, many exercises of application and self-tests and to see if you got it right. Now let's do it. Here's how it works in a sample chart. Now let's do it in your own chart. And through that repetitive process of imprinting a familiarity with not only understanding the concepts, but how to practically apply them. And that's my focus for that, is how do you take all of this stuff and use it in your charts for modern clients with modern problems, so that the knowledge you have can help you better recognize the patterns that are going on and how to be able to give the best advice based on that.
and really just taking a lot of that ancient information and a lot of research that you've done and that has come out of Project Hindsight or other researchers and breaking it down into something that's understandable to just a contemporary astrologer, a contemporary student of astrology.
Right. And so, you know, my voice in the book is I'm talking to my students. I'm saying, now, don't forget this and remember that and be sure to note this. And so it's like that's the voice of which I'm giving as if I were actually in person trying to explain something, how to do something. So it's written for the student as my audience rather than for the academic or the general public or.
Sure. I think that'll be really important, especially because there also aren't really that many intro to traditional astrology books just in general. If you define traditional astrology really broadly as from like the first century to the 17th century, there's not a lot of good books where people can just start out knowing nothing about astrology and jump into it. And then, of course, there's pretty much no intro to Hellenistic astrology books at this point. So this really will represent the sort of culmination or the fruition of, you know, the past 20 years of some of the research and some of the effort that's gone into that on the part of the astrological community to revive some of those older traditions and get them back into something that's working again for contemporary astrologers.
Right. And, you know, and we've spoken, Chris, you're also writing your own book on Hellenistic astrology. And I feel really happy that you are integrating a lot of the history and philosophy and biographies so that that material is also made available to the public. And that I feel like I've been through that through the Kepler lessons, and I don't need to recapitulate it for this. I want my focus simply to be on the student's practical application, but that you're covering all those other bases is really wonderful.
Yeah, I think it's a big load off of my shoulders where I don't have to worry about, you know, not being able to adopt that voice, but instead, you know, having a ton of footnotes and everything else. So I think together they're going to be really great sort of companion pieces as this sort of revival of these older forms of astrology really starts to come forth for the first time. All right. And so, and then you've also, of course, worked on a lot of other little side individual projects, like on medical texts for a while.
Yes.
You've done work on Thrasyllus. You did work on your own and also with me and Benjamin Dykes on the Antiochus Aspect Doctrine.
Right. I have three Hermetic medical texts that I've translated that are probably, you know, 85% ready to go with background contextual historical material. And once I get this workbook completed, that's sort of the last project on the docket. I hope that it comes to completion. That will be the seventh book. And that seems like the appropriate, magical seven number of the seven planets.
Mm-hmm.
So there is still one more piece of work behind this that I hope that life allows me to complete.
Sure. And this month you're actually focused on the Aspect Doctrine chapter in your book and sort of reviewing some of that stuff that we finalized when you did a bunch of translations of some of the ancient Aspect Doctrine material back in 2010.
Right. We realized that, you know, the Aspect material is so sophisticated and complex that even though we had translations by Bob Schmidt and James Holden, that we really couldn't understand it until I translated it word for word myself. And so that was, you know, part of the impetus was our getting together to do that. But I should say that the Hellenistic astrology is continually self-revealing. And at a certain point, you think, oh, yeah, okay, now it's clear. Now I've got it. And then you go back 6 months later and you see a whole other level of it that you couldn't understand until what you just learned, finally settled and integrated. So, we could say, oh, we finalized it a few years ago. But now as I relook at it, there's continually new material that's percolating up. So I think it's you know, as a whole, it will for some time be a work in process. And like all mystery teachings, of which the ancient authors Valens and Firmicus, like always said it was, it's continually self-revealing of outer, inner, and secret levels. That and so I don't think there'll be a sense of this is the final word, I finally got it. But at each point, as a certain amount is brought in and made one's own, then one seizes even deeper into the elegant system that exists there.
Sure. Well, and that's sort of brings us to the final point, which is that you're getting ready this summer to present, I think this is the first time you've ever done something like this, but an intensive summer workshop to present sort of like the summation of your work on Hellenistic astrology as part of a 4-day retreat, right?
Well, it's actually a 5-day retreat.
5 days, okay.
Right. And it isn't the whole everything, but it is the basic concepts of establishing planetary condition, of how to tell, looking at the conditions of sect and zodiacal sign rulerships and the solar phase under the beams, retrograde, heliacal rise set, aspects, maltreatment, how to be able to take all of that and then make a judgment about the planet. How given all of these factors, how do you decide how easy it is or likely it is that this planet can bring forth its very best for the individual whose chart it serves? And then once we have that, to then finally put the planets in the houses, and given the house the planets it occupies and the houses it rules, how to create our interpretation. So the way I have it structured is morning teachings and afternoon practicums, where kind of going back to the old Kepler model, where the class will be broken into groups, where as a group, you work through the morning method and applying it to a chart and then presenting that as a group to the rest of the class. And then the last third of each day being devoted to working on your own chart and then receiving feedback from myself and other teacher assistants if you're doing the method right in your own chart. And at that point, you can take what you have home and then begin to apply it to other charts, because you'll have a confidence in knowing that what you're doing is correct. So that's my vision for this week.
That sounds amazing. So that's going to take place in Portland from July, I think, 11th through the 15th?
Yes.
Okay. And you still have spaces open for that? And
yes.
And so that's something where you're going to be writing for the next month, but you've kind of set that almost as like a deadline for finishing most of the book as well, right?
That's what I'm hoping.
Okay. So that should be pretty amazing,
yeah,
in terms of finishing that book and then being able to,
yeah,
give this intensive as part of like a culmination or like an end to that project and,
yes,
bringing some of those threads to completion.
That's what the intention is. So it'll be 40 hours of classroom instruction and supervision. And the fee includes breakfast and lunches every day. So it's a wonderful opportunity and a really fun setting in Portland, the Kennedy School, which is an old historical school built in 1910. It's a real schoolhouse. It is renovated by the McMinimans. And so within the building are hotel rooms and classrooms and the library and restaurants and coffee shops and some pubs and a soaking pool and a movie theater and gardens. And so it's a whole event center. And within that, teaching will take place.
Awesome. Great. And people can find out more information about that on your, I'll put a link to the direct description,
okay,
page on the podcast website. And then they can check out your website as well, which is demetrageorge.com. All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of this. Do you have any future plans? I mean, of course, you continue to consult and teach. You're going to be publishing the book on Hellenistic astrology, hopefully within the next year. And then perhaps, you know, some of the follow-up, the medical texts that you mentioned. Do you have any other plans for the future?
Well, I think that by the time the medical texts are published, my best guess that'll be 4 to 5 years yet ahead. So it's hard for me at this point to project farther than that. This year I'm traveling to Norwalk and to the ESAR conference. In 2017, I'm going to attend the, Kepler, research conference in Florida that David Cochrane and Courtney Roberts are sponsoring, partially in connection with my, position as research director for the AFA. We're trying to come up with educational material to help our astrological community understand how to do research that can contribute to the knowledge in our field. So that's a side project that's going on. And of course, the NCGR conference is happening in February of 2017 that I'll be speaking at. And then finally, you know, it all culminates in UAC of May of 2018. So that's a pretty, and I'm also going to Australia in 2018. So that's a pretty active traveling schedule and writing schedule and other ways of continuing to serve the astrological community and to enjoy the incredible friendships that have fashioned a life in astrology.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a full schedule ahead of you. And, and I completely overlooked and forgot that you're the research director of the AFA, and you actually took over that position after James Holden died, who was the first research director of the AFA prior to you, right?
Right. And research has certainly not been one of my specialties or anything that I have expertise in, but that Jim had asked me if I would take it over from him in that situation. It was impossible to refuse. So I'm trying at this point to increase my learning curve with research. The AFA is giving research grants to astrologers through the various organizations as well as the AFA. There was quite a foundation left to them by Ernest and Catherine Grant, one of the initial founders of the AFA, to further research. And in conjunction with the research grants, we'd like to develop educational material for the community. So that is yet another project that I'm involved in the next few years.
Right. Yeah. And I think, I mean, especially for Holden, you know, the category of astrological research always seemed like it extended to historical research and things about reconstructing the history of astrology.
Right. Supporting that research and texts and translations is being under the umbrella of research.
Sure. All right. Well, okay. Yeah, well, thanks for doing this. I'm glad we finally got a chance
to do it. I know, me too. It's been on our minds for a while, and it's wonderful that it happened. So thank you, Chris, and for staying on me to get this particular discussion.
Definitely. Well, you've had a huge impact on, I think, you know, obviously my career as well as the career of a lot of other astrologers. So I'm glad we were able to do a show just to cover your history. And thanks for being one of the first sort of astrological biographies that I've done here.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.